Is Harry Mount editor of the greatest magazine in the universe? Welcome to Lunch with Dad. I mean, the oldie lunch. My father is speaking today, but I promise you I'm not related to the great Dame Jenny Murray and Andrew Jimson, who will be giving brilliant talks today. Before I hand over to the great Barry Cryer, I wanted to remember the oldie doctor, Dr. Thomas Stutterford, who very sadly died in June, aged 87. An extremely distinguished doctor, GP, medical journalist, and an MP, but most importantly gave the very correct medical advice that we must all have 4 glasses of wine a day to maintain perfect health. So any of you who haven't reached 4 glasses are in terrible trouble. But I'll now hand you over to the great Barry Cryer.
Thank you very much, and welcome. Stirring times lately. World Cup and Wimbledon all going on. Somebody said to me, did you get to the royal wedding? I said, I was at the royal wedding, and Wallace Simpson looked wonderful. I've warned them, we have a ritual, a convention. You regulars will know, we have the parrot joke prior to introducing our speakers. Well, we walked into the shop and there's a beautiful blue and gold parrot, and she said to the man, he's gorgeous, how much? And he said, 20 quid. She said, 20 pounds? He's beautiful. He said, well, I've got to give you the history. He's got a bit of history, he's got a form. He was in a brothel, and to put it delicately, he's got quite an extensive vocabulary. She said, 20 pounds, I'll take a chance on that. She took the parrot back to her flat and she took the cover off, and the parrot looked round and said, new place, very nice. And the two daughters walked in and the parrot said, new place, new girls, very nice indeed. And her husband walked in and the parrot said, hello, Keith. Now, to business. Our first author pursues a theme of succession, a parade of prime movers, a procession of thinkers, Pericles, Jesus Christ, via Edmund Burke. And no, I must not tarry. His claim to blame, fame. He is the father of our own Harry. For that he must be held to account. Enough. Welcome our author, Ferdinand Mount.
Thank you very much, Barry. It's a great treat to be here. The father of the editor of The Oldie, I mean, that makes you feel really antique. It ought to be a hereditary office, like Groom of the Stool or something. But anyway, it's very nice to be here. And it does get me to the lunches. I mean, that is the perk that I have. And it enables me to hear the parrot joke. I've done pretty well out of it. I'm not really, by nature, an iconoclast, but, I don't like the sort of sound of smashing plaster, but as time goes by, and for me, as for you, an awful lot of time has gone by, I've become rather impatient with some of our great political idols and their idolaters. For all their passion and eloquence, the gaps in their thinking seem to me too glaring and their contradictions too painful. And above all, the damage they've left behind too ghastly to be smoothed over. So I wanted to fire off a few pot shots while I still had the time and the energy. And for this book, I've chosen a dozen of the most brilliant, but also, I think, the most flawed of our political mentors. And this afternoon, for you, I've picked out a couple of them. And I'm going to start with Thomas Jefferson of Virginia. twice President of the United States, the inventor of American democracy in many people's minds, the author of the Declaration of Independence. And you can see him up there carved on Mount Rushmore, staring serenely out of the over the Dakota Plains on the shoulder of George Washington. They originally carved him on the other shoulder, but the stone was too crumbly, so they had to start carving him on this side. He looks a little uncomfortable, but he is there, and he is the only one of the four great presidents carved on Mount Rushmore who has this real reputation as a political thinker, a great political thinker. And the opening lines of his Declaration of Independence still sing out to us. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Tremendous stuff. Yet at the time, some of Jefferson's colleagues who were on the drafting committee weren't that impressed by it. Crusty old John Adams, who was to be his predecessor as President of the United States, called it a commonplace compilation, its sentiments hackneyed in Congress for 2 years before. In fact, some weeks earlier, when Jefferson was 300 miles away, down in Virginia, his home state, they'd put together their own Declaration of Rights, written by a chap called George Mason, whom nobody's ever heard of. He's not even the original of the Mason-Dixon line. And that was almost identical in wording, including life, liberty, and the pursuing of happiness. So not as original as all that. And as for the Constitution of the United States, which we all also think in connection with Jefferson, he was in Paris the whole time it was being drafted. And when they sent him the text, he didn't think much of it. So his reputation as a constitutional theorist is not as strong as all that. At least he did actually draft the Declaration. But his admirers have a harder time glorifying his role during the War of Independence, which he'd given this clarion call to his fellow countrymen. But in fact, during the war, he was governor of Virginia, and he did nothing very much, and he didn't do that very well. And in fact, when the British came towards him, he fled, not once, but twice. First, he scarpered to his beloved Monticello, and then he sort of did a double scarper onto another of his estates in a place called Carter's Mountain. Years afterwards, his opponents still ridiculed him as the coward of Carter's Mountain. When, of course, he became president and hero of the American Revolution and so on, all that was forgotten, but it was very bitter at the time. But he was, of course, famous as an intellectual. Jack Kennedy said, when he was greeting a group of Nobel Prize winners at the White House, he said, "This is the most distinguished gathering in American history at the White House since the time when Thomas Jefferson dined alone." So, you know, he was really revered. But in fact, he only wrote one book. It's called The Notes on Virginia. And it's actually a peculiar and in some ways rather repellent book. First of all, far from welcoming immigrants to the young country, Jefferson said, "There are too many flooding in." Does that remind you of somebody? "And most of the wrong sort from the wrong countries." That also reminds you of somebody. He wanted a lot of honest farmers. He didn't want people from the deplorable countries. He had actually, he ran a quite successful nail factory himself, but he didn't actually want any more industry polluting his rural Virginia of his dreams. But that didn't stop there. It wasn't just he only wanted America to be agricultural. He wanted it to be entirely white. And he insisted that he wanted the blacks to be emancipated, yes, and that's what he's remembered for, but he wanted them, once emancipated and grown and grown up, to be deported. And he wanted them to be replaced by whites from other countries. Blacks out, whites in. Why? Why this extraordinary exercise in human engineering? Because there were such natural distinctions between the races, Jefferson tells us, that it could only end in all-out race war in which one or the other race would be exterminated. An extravagant prophecy. But why did he think that? He said because these natural distinctions were so ineradicable that blacks and whites could never live together. Blacks, he said, are uglier. I'm sorry at this point, I do have to tell you those of a delicate disposition should lock their ears because it is so shocking to hear the founder of the American dream talk like this. Blacks are uglier, they have a peculiar smell, they are stupider than whites. I think one could be scarcely found capable of understanding Euclid, and in imagination they are dull, tasteless, and anomalous. The one concession, the only one concession he gives to blacks is that they have a superior sense of rhythm. That too we've heard elsewhere. Now this wasn't just a kind of youthful quirk. He was still saying the same thing 40 years later. In his autobiography, written in his late 70s, he asserts no less plainly that the blacks must be emancipated and then got rid of. And he said nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people are to be free. That these people are to be free. Thank you very much, sir. Nor is it less certain, this is the second sentence, nor is it less certain that the two races equally free cannot live in the same government. Now, if you go to the Jefferson Monument Memorial in Washington, D.C., dedicated by FDR in 1943, the bicentenary of St. Jefferson's birth, you'll see the last words of the inscription. Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people are to be free. But the inscription stops there. The lie that hides Jefferson's vision of an all-white America is graven in stone at the heart of the American pantheon. So that's Jefferson. If I've got a little time left, I'll just give you a little bit on my other chosen prime mover of this afternoon, Pericles of Athens. Was there ever such a man, so inspiring a leader in war and peace, so bold a thinker, such an irresistible orator, such a paragon of public and private virtue? When Boris Johnson was mayor of London, he chose Pericles of Athens as his model, in a spirit, I think, combined of hero worship and self-worship. He claimed to see in London the same spirit of Pericles that Pericles exalted, a spirit of democracy and tolerance and cultural effervescence and mass political participation. Pericles' three famous speeches, as reported by the historian Thucydides, have been taught to generations of schoolboys as the greatest oratory ever. It's so entrancing, and they read beautifully today. We don't stop to note what the speeches are all about, and they are about one thing and one thing only, which is to persuade the Athenian public to plug on with their catastrophic war against Sparta and to disregard all peace overtures from the much maligned Spartans because the war was the only thing that mattered. He did succeed in steadying the nerve of the Athenians, but the cost was terrible. The war, which we call the Peloponnesian War, went on for another 20 years after Pericles' death. It destroyed the power of Athens, and for a time, Athenian democracy too. Yet Pericles himself seems to have been blind to the horrors that he'd unleashed. His dying words, again, as reported by Plutarch, are breathtaking in their self-deception. No Athenian, he says, now alive, has put on mourning clothes because of me, which was blatantly untrue. Thousands of them had died. Nor was he a kind of nice, liberal type of guy. He was so determined to restrict citizenship to purebred Athenians that his own son by a foreign wife was excluded. As for the glorious Parthenon, as beautiful as ever, under Pericles, it wasn't a temple at all. It was a strongroom for all the loot that Athens had extracted from her satellites. And it was this loot from all those islands across the Aegean which paid for the whole Acropolis complex. This isn't just sort of hindsight. At the time, people said, this isn't the right thing to do. We shouldn't be screwing all this money out of these islands just to build a beautiful temple. But on Pericles went. And lastly about Pericles, how had he come to rule over Athens in the first place? Very largely by leading vicious and sustained campaigns to have his chief rivals ostracized, that is, exiled for 10 years. You know how it worked, that you all had to scratch on a little piece of pottery the name of whoever it was you wanted to get rid of. And very recently, really, archaeologists have recovered handfuls of ostracoi, all with the names of the intended victims scratched upon them, all scratched in what is clearly the same hand, i.e. they were distributed by the Pericles campaign team to make sure that his great rivals were chucked out for 10 years. By comparison, Donald Trump's campaign methods were positively scrupulous. So anyway, there you have them, two heroic thinkers and doers, as much admired today by millions as they were in their own lifetime. Very different men, but they had, I think, three things in common. First of all, each of them had unstoppable self-belief. Secondly, each of them never hesitated to discredit and, if possible, destroy his rivals. Pericles, we've seen with his ostracoi plotting endlessly. Jefferson, the saintly Jefferson, such a mild face, he actually employed the seediest drunken hacks, which, I mean, people who make my old colleagues seem positively respectable, to dig up dirt and fling it at Hamilton and Adams. And the very brilliant musical brings all that into play. And thirdly, what they have in common is their charm. Even reading their speeches and writings long after the scales have fallen from your eyes, you still find it hard to resist the sweet eloquence of Pericles and the soaring idealism of Jefferson. And it's that charm which is the most dangerous thing of all, for it leads us into thinking that they've discovered a single valid answer to the theory of the problems of living it together, a theory of everything, or what the physicists call a TOE. But in political life, which is real life, in that sense, no TOE exists. We're stuck with complexity and diversity, and we have to find workable solutions and trade-offs and work with these complexities rather than against them. Life is complicated, and it's going to stay complicated. And I haven't even mentioned Brexit. Thank you very much indeed.